Hello, friends. Welcome to episode 17 of a year-long conversation. Today we're going to be talking about are politically correct liberals the new social conservatives. We'll explain what we mean a little bit by that. But first, let me bring out my co-host, Blue in Alabama's Michael. Michael, how's it going?
It's going. Feeling a little politically correct tonight, so that's always a good thing.
I know, but we're going to push some buttons. Had the last Democratic debate between Hillary and Bernie where they were screaming over each other.
Certainly not politically correct.
Pretty much a family reunion you didn't want to be at was how it was the whole vibe of the evening, and New York's right around the corner and everything, and I think it's a good week to get into the main theme, because with New York coming around, and there's been a lot of debate about exactly what New York is. Ted Cruz, he's talking about New York values, and Trump's from New York, Bernie's from New York, Hillary was a senator in New York, and so there's kind of they've all got very different opinions about New York and exactly what it represents.
Yeah, they do. It's pretty interesting to hear. I mean, you know, New York is a unique city in that they say that it's got something for everyone, but it apparently represents everyone in different ways, too.
Except, apparently, Ted Cruz apparently doesn't have anything for
him.
And yet, he's trying to win votes there. I saw where he held a fundraiser dinner or something, and about half the room walked out because they were just like, oh, Ted Cruz. And I thought, oh, why are you even bothering to campaign in the state that you went out of your way to insult?
Yeah. I'm surprised he didn't come out and be like, oh, when I said New York values, I meant that in a positive way.
Nothing would surprise me about Ted Cruz. And we're kind of seeing different groups write off different areas of the country. Ted Cruz is New York values, and Washington, D.C. is evil, and Chicago. Obama's from Chicago. And, I mean, there's those whole areas that he won't go to. And, yet, on the Democratic side, Bernie seems content to do basically the same thing, where he's talking about the Southeast and being like, well, thank God we're out of the South. I couldn't wait to live there fast enough. Now I can win a
state. Yeah, he brought that up during the debate, talking about how Hillary basically just mopped the floor with him in the South and didn't seem to care about it.
She's made several comments being very dismissive about her wins in the South and been like, well, she won the South. A lot of good it'll do her because she'll never win Alabama. But I think that's really, really short-sighted. I think that really misses the point. And I think there's really two points I think that is number one is that, first of all, five states with the highest percentage of black people as a percentage of their state are in the South. So you have Mississippi, Alabama, Georgia, Louisiana, and South Carolina. So when he's basically being dismissive of the South, and then, of course, Texas and Florida are very diverse states as well, he's kind of dismissing the Democratic electorate. The Democratic electorate is about half minority, and we're the first political party in America to be minority-majority. And when he's saying that, it'd be like, well, we left Alabama in the dust, now on to Idaho. I'm not sure he's really sending the right message in terms of being so dismissive about those minority wins for Hillary.
I don't think he's really looking at it that way. I think he's just simply looking at it as he got beat, and he got beat in a region, so that region isn't important to him.
He's using a really outdated notion of what the South is, too. Like, I think he's, because again, Bernie's pure fucking Vermont. The guy probably bleeds maple syrup. I know he's technically from New York, but again, he left Brooklyn at the time Brooklyn was becoming black. Brooklyn used to be the majority Polish and Italian. He left about that time. When you watch last year's movie that was nominated for Best Picture, Brooklyn, everybody was like, why is everybody in this movie white? And I was like, well, it's set in the 50s. So, I mean, at that time, Brooklyn was, and he left Brooklyn about that time to go to Vermont. So I think he's looking at it as like this guy who's been in Vermont and all this stuff. And his idea of like South is really the cable guy. He's not even from the South. He's from Nebraska.
Yeah.
So I think he's got this idea of like, well, I lost the Hank Williams Jr. vote, you know, laughing that off. And I think he's get a really limited idea of what the South is. In terms of their population, the South's always had a pretty decent amount of minority. But people don't believe that. For years, when I would tell people, you should visit Alabama, I'm not going to go get lynched. And I'm like, well, they've actually got as many black people as anywhere in the Northeast does, but people they don't believe that. They don't think that's true.
Right.
I think he's got a really specific, and again, he barely campaigned in the South, so it's like, how would he know any differently when he just barely stepped foot in Alabama, and Mississippi and Georgia, he barely campaign there. So his idea of the state, how can you change it when you won't go there? That's number one, is he's being too dismissive about a region that it looks a lot like the future of the Democratic Party. They said 60-something percent of the Democratic voters in Mississippi are black. In Alabama and Georgia and Louisiana, it's almost the same. It's almost that high. And that looks a lot like the future of the Democratic Party. I think that's number one. Number two, even if Hillary doesn't win any states in the Southeast, she's better for congressional and Senate Democrats who need to take back some of those areas, because right now the entire Southeast is pretty much got a blockade against Democratic senators, and you'll need at least one or two of those seats to flip. I mean, you can't have an entire region of the country where it's just lost to congressional Democrats.
Yeah.
And it used to be, they used to own this region. I mean, until LBJ, Democrats owned the Southeast. The congressional gains, especially in the House of Representatives, that they really need to make are pretty much in the Southeast. It's foolish for a Democratic presidential candidate to not get that and to not care about it.
You know, I think Bernie's looking at it, like you said, very short-sightedly. Democratic presidential candidate may not win, but a Democratic representative may have a shot. And it's those small steps that could really make a big change on the federal government. Taking back the House, taking back the Senate, things like that. That's things that need to be done. The presidency will be a good thing, but you need a Congress as well that's going to get things done. And you do that more on a local level. And Bernie doesn't look at that. I think that's why you don't really see him campaigning for congressional candidates and donating money to these undercard races and things like that. I mean, he's looking at it for the presidency and the presidency only. He's looking at it for himself.
With even more local races like the state Senate and the state House and then the governor's races, because you can pass all the federal bills you want to, but if a state like Alabama refuses to enact any of it, they can they can jam for a decade. I mean, and they've done that on almost everything. Even when Obama was like, here, take some stimulus money, you know, get away from us, Obama. We don't want we were getting on us. Like, I mean, Obama's trying to give them more money for Medicaid. Alabama's state government wouldn't take it, tried to give them stimulus money. Their state government wouldn't take it. For a little while, they were talking about building it was like a high-speed rail between Birmingham and Atlanta. They were going to build like a rail, spin the two cities and connect them. Alabama state government was like, who would want that? No, please, get rid of that. So the state governments are really important, and people almost never, ever think about that stuff. Even if you barely know who your congressman is, your state senator and your state representative, you might know who that person is. You might not even know that that's your state rep, but you may know him from a car dealership, or you might know him from owning a restaurant, or you might know him from just being on television all the time. So that's really important, because even though the national Congress is just at a standstill, I mean, this is the do-nothing Congress multiplied, and this Congress right now is, I think, even less productive than that Congress was.
Yeah.
But your state governments especially in red states, they've been passing bills like people eat M&Ms. They've just been flying through these bills. And when you look at a lot of the regression and a lot of the rollbacks happened, it's been through state governments. And Hillary gets that. And because Bill Heaton, he was the governor of Arkansas, and they know a little bit more about state politics in the South. And I mean, look, Bernie, you know, he can pass free college tuition all he wants to if a state like Alabama refuses to enact any of it. And if it doesn't matter, I mean, it doesn't do any good.
Yeah.
I don't think people know that. But I also think if Hillary is a nominee, the Southeast is not, when he was dismissing that and saying, well, she'll never win, that's really true, because she will probably win Florida, and she'll probably win Virginia and North Carolina, and those are the South. I mean, she covered his ass in Virginia and North Carolina and Florida, and she has a decent shot at winning those. She's also got a decent shot at winning Arkansas. Bill Clinton, when he ran for president, I mean, he won like Arkansas and Georgia and Tennessee, and just clipping like two or three of those 13 states, enough to win in 92. With Hillary, she might do the same thing. But if you get totally shut out of the South, meaning you lose all the things with the states we think of as the South, as well as Virginia and Florida, it's going to be really hard to win the presidency. In 2000, we always think about Florida costing Al Gore the race, and it did, but Al Gore didn't carry his home state, Tennessee. That made a big difference, too. Any Democrat that gets totally shut out of the South is really hard to win, and Obama hasn't been. He's won Virginia, North Carolina, Florida. Hillary probably will, plus maybe pick up one or two, and I think it's a more important region than a lot of people are acting like it is right now.
I agree with that.
And it's kind of misleading, too, because a lot of Bernie's big victories have been in these caucus states like Utah and Idaho and Alaska. I mean, is a Democrat going to win those? No. There hasn't been a Democrat to win Alaska since LBJ and Goldwater. I mean, it's the most reliably conservative state there is. Utah? No, of course the Democrat's not going to win Utah. Idaho and Kansas and Nebraska. I mean, so a lot of his victories have been these caucus states that any Democrat would probably lose.
One of the biggest Bernie moments of the night was they were talking about climate change, and Bernie said that Hillary she hasn't done enough on climate change, and her record didn't really bear that she supported acting on climate change, because she went around showing these countries fracking techniques rather than trying to get them to clean energy. And she came back in with a rebuttal saying that getting them into natural gas was a better source of energy than coal, but it wasn't meant as a permanent solution, just a temporary one until we get to 100% clean energy. She brought up a bill that she had got passed. She said that there was 195 countries that signed on to support it, and it was one of the biggest pieces of legislation ever to act on climate change, and that Bernie didn't even support that. And when the moderator asked him about it, Bernie basically turned around and said, well, it was a lot of paperwork. It just didn't get enough accomplished. It's a lot of words, but it doesn't really do a lot. And I think that right there, just the fact that Bernie, just because it's a lot of words, I think really what it is, it was a lot of words that he just couldn't read them all.
Bernie's pretty damn lazy. They'll ask him the bills you're talking about with other examples of bills. They'll be like, so, write up your contribution. Whoa, whoa, whoa. I just want to harass you about not being liberal enough. I don't want to actually sit down and write up a suit. I want to sit down and actually, like, do my homework.
He's such a bad candidate. I don't know how his voters don't see it.
I'd like to know who's pulling the strings. I think either the Republicans or maybe Hillary herself. The reason I say that is because a lot of people have said, like, Karl Rove and a lot of, like, the former Karl Rove's people, they're behind Bernie's campaign and all these small donations he gets. I mean, Bernie's fans supposedly don't have a pot to piss in, so where are they getting a couple of $100 to give him every month?
But I
would be surprised if the Clintons masterminded Bernie's campaign, because it seems like he's almost single-handedly designed to make them look better. Because think about what Republicans have been saying for 8 years. Hillary will be the death of America. Hillary's a socialist. She's a communist.
Yeah.
She's a Nazi. She'll have our balls in a vice. They'll be like, she's the worst person the Democrats could pick. And then here comes Bernie, 100-year-old socialist in Vermont, who looks Bernie's like a Scott character of what they think a Democratic presidential candidate would be, like in a Glenn Beck novel. If he wrote, like, the bad guy was a Democratic presidential candidate, it would be Bernie, and there'd be some massive conspiracy, like, they're like, we're going to take over the banks, but the government's going to be the big bank, and it'd be like the big sinister plot of the whole thing. We're going to make America communist and some scheme. It almost seems like he's designed to make Hillary look better to moderates, because when Hillary finally wins the nomination, moderates will be like, well, at least they didn't pick Bernie. Now, overnight, Hillary has gone from being the most liberal abomination Republicans can imagine to, like, being called a sellout every day and being too corporate or whatever. They're going to keep calling her corporate so much that Republicans are going to be like, I'm starting to think about this Hillary character. So I want to know more about her. You know? They're going to start coming around on her. So but we got a really big theme, and I've been excited to talk about this, and there's never been a good time, but now that I said in last week's podcast, we've hit the Stalingrad portion of this race. I mean, it's going to continue. Bernie is going to be there until Hillary gets every last delegate she needs. And even then, he may not quit because he might think he can put the super delegate. I think the race is stagnant. Trump and Cruz's, their Republican thing is going to go all the way down. The only real race on the Republican side is if Trump can hit 1237. On the Democratic side, it's can Bernie live to July or not. So, I mean, there's really, the race is continuing, and it's in the news every single day. And the media is loving it. I mean, CNN, they advertised that debate like a fucking boxing match. I mean, it was like Mayweather-Pacquiao. Hillary and Bernie go at it. They touch gloves. They were so excited to have a debate because they hadn't had one in about a month. They were so thrilled to have one. They just had this glee of promoting this thing. Like, I thought they would charge the pay-per-view price.
Even afterwards, they were calling it the Brooklyn Brawl.
Yeah, I saw that on the news. Candidates face off. It'll be like the candidate bar. I saw one mock-up promotional thing they did where Bernie and Hillary were like, they had cut two different pictures of them, like they were facing each other and the shadows were dark. It looked like what they used in boxing matches. It looked like that same thing where they take their face to put them against each other, like the poster of face off or something.
Yeah.
Like, Bernie, Hillary, only one can win. They're just so desperate. I thought, what if they both showed up and were like, we decided that we love each other and we just want to agree about all these. They'd be like, oh no, please. You know, they'd be like, we decided that we just want to have a good, clean debate and express our opinions about what's best for America and not call each other names. In fact, we're going to hold hands and Bernie's going to have one of his nieces play Kumbaya on a loop. CNN, their hearts would just sink in that news.
Yeah,
the morale would be so low. Yeah, they tried so hard to make it dramatic, but it's not. It's kind of a snooze. And so this is a great time to talk about a growing theme that we've seen where politically correct liberals have really become the new social conservatives at a time when America is becoming less and less socially conservative. I think the big theme of the last 50 years has been that economic liberalism has really not gotten hardly anything that it wants. Like, we're at a worse position since Reagan, but social liberalism has gotten almost everything that it wants.
Yeah.
So we're kind of hitting a weird dichotomy to where, and America has become less socially conservative, which I think is a great thing. You're going to see presidential candidates in the future that you never could have imagined a few decades ago. Like, nobody has even mentioned that Bernie's divorced. Nobody's even mentioned that he had a kid with somebody he wasn't married to. Same thing with Trump. He's winning evangelical votes, and he's been divorced twice. These are things that people, we sure do love this perfect candidate, but he's been divorced. I mean, like, they used to throw somebody away for any little thing. And I kind of love that social conservatism's collapsed, because you're going to see candidates that they don't have to be perfect. They don't have to have a picture-perfect background, and it's not going to matter as much. And you're going to get some brilliant people that used to would have been dismissed a while ago. So I like that. But I think the problem is that politically correct liberals have picked up some of that slack from social conservatives, and they've kind of changed it to being like, 10 years ago, you could barely say the word transgender on television.
Yeah.
And then now, every transgender person in America has got their own reality show, and if you don't watch it, you're transphobic or whatever. Like, if you're like, well, I don't really think RuPaul's very interesting. Well, you would think that, bigot.
Yeah.
And I feel like there's a connective tissue. Like, I feel like in both cases, it's not really about the issues. It's about, I'm a really good person. I feel like that's the common link.
Yeah.
Because especially conservative in Alabama, everybody you meet just about is Christian, just about.
Yeah.
And when I'd meet somebody and they'd be like, I'm a Christian, I'd be like, okay, they're a Christian. When they say, I'm a Christian five times in a 10-minute conversation, I'd make sure my wallet was still in my pocket. Like, it felt like they were trying way too hard to convince you they were a good person. Like, it felt like it was just, I really want you to know I'm a good person, and maybe I'm a televangelist, maybe I'm a huckster, you know? And with politically correct liberals, I feel like it's the same thing. It's exactly the same thing. Like, whenever you say, well, that's a 94 crime bill, that didn't really lead to the mass incarceration. Are you saying that we've got black people in jail? And I'm like, that's not at all what I just said. But it feels like it's not really a place for them to... It feels like they don't really care about any of this stuff. It feels like it's just a way to score points and a way to say, I'm a really good person, and this person who made a bad comment and they got called out for it, they're a bad person, and I'm going to tear them down so I'll look better. And it feels like that's what these two things have in common. These two groups who really don't agree on anything, the sole connective tissue is about, I'm going to appear to be a better person than I am.
Right. Yeah. I think you've hit the nail on the head.
And Michael, when you say nail on the head, are you talking about a racist, sexist slur? Is that what you're using right now? Is that the kind of language you really want to use in front of America?
You know, I guess I need to rethink that.
That there is no head, there is no nail. We have a shapeless, amorphous blob that has no color and no gender.
Yeah.
It can be a man or a woman. We don't define the sexuality of that nail, and we don't define the color of it. It could be a dark gray, or it could be a bright silver. It's really none of our business, and we don't see it in
either
way.
Exactly.
And
we
just have to accept the nail for who it is, Michael. And we shouldn't even hit it, because what kind of barbarism
in
society where we're still hammering nails? Why can't we not get rid of this relic of the past?
That's true. So I apologize to all the nails out there.
And 95% of the people who talk that way on Twitter are white males, which is, I just have to look at this and think, like, it's not really about these issues. Like, I don't think people who are getting into this stuff and this is racist, this is sexist, this is homophobic, this is transphobic, this is Islamophobic, that's become a big one. But I don't know if they really care about any of this stuff. Like, I think it's all just about, like, I'm a white male, pin a medal on my chest for being so cool with all this. Sometimes on Twitter, when I hear somebody talk, I'm like, hold still so I can pin that medal on your chest. Like, they feel like after they say something, somebody's going to give them a round of applause. Like, these are a good trophy. Why don't you take this?
And the worst part is, I think that a lot of people who are saying the things that they're saying don't really believe what they're saying. Like you said, they're saying it hoping to get some type of recognition for it, but they don't believe it.
Okay, so elephant in the room. When you've got a white male who's talking about political correctness as a bad thing, I think people, they instantly hear, it seems a little tone deaf. I think that they hear that and they think, oh, poor you or whatever. And it's not really that it's like it's affecting me in any way. I think it's affecting more like the conversation, because there's so many things now that you can't even have a conversation about. And I think it's kind of eroding like any type of nuance. And so, for example, this is just one example, and there's many, many examples. A lot of these examples take place on college campuses. If you got the Tea Party and Fox News and all this, people say, well, there's no liberal equivalent. Oh, there absolutely is. It's just that they're not a part of Congress. And we'll see if Bernie changes that or not. The right wing crazies, they're in power. They're on television and they're in Congress, and they're like, they're like on the board of directors at like a Fortune 500 company. So they're in a lot of power. It doesn't mean liberal crazies don't exist. They're just on campus, and they're just protesting nonsense, and they're just, like, filing petitions like fucking nuisance lawsuits at these colleges. So one example is at Emory College a couple of weeks ago. There was a student, and all he did was write Trump 2016 in chalk around the school. He wrote Trump, or 2016, yeah. Trump theme, and it was just the most innocuous, like, it's just the candidate that he supports, as is their right in a free society.
Yeah.
Emory went apeshit. The students complained, and they said, we want to know, I feel like my security is being threatened at the school that I chose. Like, we need a safe space to feel like we're safe in this environment.
Yeah.
And the Emory College took it seriously. They're like, we're going to review security camera footage, and then we're going to take appropriate disciplinary action against this student. And I'm like, for what?
Yeah.
You know, like, what are you taking action about? He didn't write, Trump's going to get rid of all the Mexicans. He wrote Trump 2016, and I mean,
In chalk,
which is people wash it off. He didn't write it in, like, the blood of an illegal that he killed personally. he didn't write it in, like, the blood of a pig on the side of a mosque. Be like, take this, you bastard. I mean, and I thought, when liberals act that way, it makes us look bad. Like, it reinforces stereotypes that people have. People have a certain set of stereotypes. This is a really thing for me to talk about, because I lived in Alabama for all those years, as you know, and then I lived in New York, Minneapolis, and Los Angeles. And I think that people in Alabama, they have, people in New York and L.A., they have stereotypes about Alabama, of course. Like, when Governor Bentley, when he was having sex with an intern, I was thrilled that she wasn't related to him in any way.
Yeah.
I was just really happy that it wasn't like his third cousin or something, even though too many people I know who have actually committed incest are Italian guys in New York, taped their second cousin. So I never actually met anybody in Alabama who was, like, engaged to a second cousin. But I mean, people have their stereotypes, and I'm not saying that those aren't true. There's definitely a lot of racists in Alabama. There's definitely a lot of rednecks and a lot of religious nuts more than anything. But I mean, so there are stereotypes, and some of them are true. But I think people in Alabama, they have their own set of stereotypes, really, about liberal culture in general. And when they see things like, a guy can't write Trump 2016 without being kicked out of his school, the president said if he's a student, we will take disciplinary action. If he's not a student, the police will be notified. When a guy can't write chalk outline without the police being called, I'm just like, I think that plays into what conservatives think about liberals. Like, that plays into their stereotypes about what they think of as a typical liberal. Oversensitive, humorless, got to call the government into everything. The police have got to get involved. The administration's got to get involved. Like, there can't be such a thing as, like, a wash it off or a handshake and apology. Like, everything's got to be, like, 8 layers of bureaucracy's got to be brought into it. There's got to be the media that's got to be brought into it. We've got to have think pieces about it. There's got to be blogs and articles and being like, well, how wrong is it that somebody said something bad at a Chipotle while I was waiting in line? There's been all kind of stories about there'll be a customer at a restaurant and they don't like that their waiter, if it's a woman and she's a single mom, they'll say something to her. If it's a gay guy, they'll say something to him. And the waiter will take the receipt and he'll put some note that he gave them or whatever, put it on Instagram, and they'll go online and say, this is my story, this is my struggle.
Yeah.
And they'll kind of go to this. I think that, is this really, like, you are this big champion of, like, this issue you're talking about, or do you just want to be famous for 5 minutes?
Yeah, exactly. And I think for even the fact that it makes liberals look bad, it does. It does feed into the series. But it's also feeding into a lot of Trump supporters, if you only look at it from the political aspect.
Yeah.
This is the nonsense
Trump. I mean, this is what's driving him. And people, it's funny when you corner Trump supporters and you put them on camera and you say, why do you support Trump? And their eyes would kind of shift. And they're like, well, he's good for the economy, and he's a businessman. And, you know, and they'll name some stuff that they don't really truly believe or care about.
Yeah.
And then after a couple of minutes, and he doesn't put up with this politically correct bullshit, and they'll start going into this rant about it.
Yeah.
Like, that's what it really is. They had a thing about, why does Trump do well with evangelical voters? Like, how in the world does this loudmouth New Yorker who's been divorced twice call people every day? And he's going all over the place with these names. How does this guy get evangelical support? Because they asked Trump, they said, what's your favorite passage of the Bible? And he couldn't name a passage of the Bible. Like, he said, he said the Bible's his favorite book after The Art of the Deal. Like, but he couldn't name a passage of it. And Bobby Jindal, the only funny thing Bobby Jindal has ever said in his life was, well, Trump's never read the Bible because he's not in it. That's not all the good line Jindal's ever had, which, you know, somebody wrote it. But, but with Trump, they said, well, this guy doesn't even know anything about the Bible. How? And they said, well, we know he's not really a Christian, and we know he's not really evangelical. But the thing is, if we had somebody like Ben Carson or Ted Cruz or something like that, yeah, we would have a good foot soldier for a couple of years. But Trump is a tank.
Yeah.
Like, he's a tank. He's going to bulldoze through the paradigm. He's going to shift the table. He's going to flip the table because right now they feel cornered. And I think, look, I totally believe LGBT equality, the idea of gay people not being able to get married is nonsense. This is an issue that should have been done away with. Like, it's not even an issue, really. I hate that it even is an issue because conservatives like the Koch brothers and Grover Norquist, who support marriage equality, they look like moderates. They use it to look more moderate.
Yeah.
And so it shouldn't even be an issue. But to a big chunk of Americans, they went from 10 years ago, not a single state in America had gay marriage, and now every transgender person in America has their own reality show. And that's where they've come in 10 years. It's a good thing, but I think, of course, there's going to be a reaction to that, because for every action, there's a reaction, especially in American politics. People are constantly reacting to stuff. Conservatives have seen all this social progress that's happened in the last 10 years. America's first black president, the first president who's had a Muslim father, the first president of an interracial marriage, the first president whose dad is from Africa, gay marriage in all 50 states, legalizing marijuana in 4 states, and almost certainly more states to come. And I think that they're looking at all these things, and I think that that's what's driving this thing behind Trump, is that all these things that we think of as really positive for them, it seems like a lot in a really short amount of time. It's not just that these things are happening, it's that these things are happening and liberals seem almost completely, seem almost completely like it's no big deal. Who gives a shit? This should have happened a long time ago. I mean, the day after, the day after Oregon legalized marijuana, it was like, how come Idaho ain't got it? Like, there was, they didn't go, they went from something that 2 years ago, if you'd have said, this is, marijuana's going to be legalized for everybody, they would have laughed you out of the fucking room, to then they got it, and then 2 weeks later, well, how come it wasn't faster? And how come this other state ain't got it? And what's up with, you know, and it all this progress that's been made, and people don't even really think it's progress.
No, they don't.
With Obama, I feel sometimes people, they really don't understand how big a deal it is that Barack Obama became president. They really don't get it, because people say, well, yeah, he's the first minority president in America. No, not in America. In the history of the world, there's never been a democratically elected minority president. Europe's never had a black president. Canada's never had one. Australia's never had one. Asia's never had one. Africa's never had a democratically elected white president. You go all around the world, like, this has never happened before. Like, it's not just an American phenomenon, it's a worldwide phenomenon. And literally a couple of months after he was president, it was like, well, who cares? It's not a big deal. I think that that's fixing the conservatives' mind to where, I don't agree with this, but a lot of conservatives I've heard talk say, you can't give liberals everything they want because it'll never be good enough. More and they want more and they want more. And I don't agree with that. But I think when you have these big social advances like what we're talking about, and then a year later people are like, well, who cares? Why has more stuff not changed for me? And where's my check in the mail every month that should have done happen?
I think
they hear that and they say, well, we're right.
It feeds into that narrative that they have. Mississippi State, apparently a group of black students have filed a letter to the university demanding a bunch of things, including separate facility for them to go to be able to escape basically the struggles and stresses of going to school at a predominantly white institution. And they need somewhere to get away and get with other people who go through the same struggles and have the same experiences that they have.
The only thing worse than going to a majority white college is not going to a college at all, which I think, I really want to nail down the psychology of this because it's so important, and people, they dismiss it. Like, they hear people, like, they would hear these students on the liberal side and they would say, of course, give them their demands. And I think if a white person didn't like those demands, I think they would dismiss that, and they would, but I think the psychology is so important. If you have a group of black college students are really angry these days, and a lot of it has nothing to do with student loan debt, which is something they should be mad about. But I think if they think college campuses are racist and sexist and homophobic, wait until they get to corporate America. Like, wait until they, like, wait until they join the army. Wait until they do anything else besides be on a college campus.
Yeah.
And I think what they're seeing is, like, here's a group of black students at Mississippi State, and they want basically a shadow campus set up. They basically want, like, a safe space that's pretty much, they say, for all minority students. But I think we pretty much know that there's not a ton of Hispanic and Asian students in Mississippi State. It's going to be for black students, basically a segregated zone. And it is. And I think if there's a white guy who works, like, at a chicken plant, deboning chickens all day, and he's, like, Joe working class, and he sees there's a black college student, they're going to have a better life than I've got. They're in college, they're going to graduate, they're going to make more money. They're not going to work in a sweatshop or an animal processing plant or like a factory, and they're not happy, and they want a separate space to deal with the pressures of everyday life. and my pressures of everyday life are basically making a really bad wage to be on chickens all day. That psychology is a little bit of what's driving the support for Trump. And I think it's misplaced because Trump, again, he's a billionaire. He's Mitt Romney with a more populist touch, but the guy still would be the wealthiest president we've ever had. And I think that they feel like he's speaking for white America. Just, it's not even really economics, and it's not even really, it transcends ideology. It's more about a feeling. It's more about that feeling in the back of somebody's head.
Yeah.
See, Barack Obama, he's had such a tough time. He's not just combating racism. He's combating Islamophobia because his dad was a Muslim. He's combating xenophobia because his dad was a Kenyan. He's combating homophobia because he's the first president to ever support gay marriage. The last Democratic president, and I love Bill Clinton, but he did do the Defense of Marriage Act, which is not exactly gay-friendly. And then the integration thing where his parents were an interracial couple, which I think is a whole different kind of people don't like him than if they were just Ben Carson. They've even seen Ben Carson be like, I'm blacker than Obama because both my parents are black. And it's Ben, you idiot. You're so black. How come Republicans like you?
Yeah.
And I've heard Alabama people say that. Like people who really don't like Obama. Obama's not even black. He's only half black. I don't know why he's black. And I'm like, well, he's black enough that you wouldn't let him in your house. Okay? He's the president of the United States and you wouldn't let him in your house. I think he's black enough. Okay? I think he's black enough. Even the drug thing where he's not really going after states that have legalized marijuana. He's not really like hammered down on that, which Chris Christie and some Republicans that are crime and justice Republicans, they don't like that aspect. On a Vice episode, he went to a prison and talked to prisoners. Ooh, they didn't like that one either.
Yeah.
So I think he's had to combat so many different ingrained forms of prejudice and social conservatism and all these things. The psychology behind these things is important. And I think a lot of it is the racism, the xenophobia, the Islamophobia. But I think if you hear a story like the Emory College students that cannot even see the word Trump without feeling that there's spaces. I'm thinking this fucking guy's been on television every day for like 2 years. He's on TV more than the Verizon guys or, you know, he's on TV all the time. You cannot avoid Donald Trump the last 2 years. I'm not saying that he should be on television that much, but you would think he'd be a little bit numb to the effects of him because he's just there all the time. And I think if you can't even see the word Trump and you're afraid that one of your students in your classroom is a Trump supporter, people that see that are conservative or they're moderate or they're independent and they're on the fence and they don't like that, it's so easy to dismiss that as just out and out racism, and it's so hard to really look past that and get into the psychology of, and the last 50, my life hasn't turned out the way it was meant to. Like, I think when you look at guys like Joe the Plumber, I don't know if people remember him, McCain's pet working class guy, you know, McCain is like, oh, Joe the Plumber, he's not for Obama, like, he speaks for anybody. But Joe the Plumber in 2008, his whole reason for liking the Republicans was, well, Obama wants a tax package, so the imaginary business in my head that I'm going to get one day down the road, I'm going to get killed on the taxes on this thing. He didn't have a business. He didn't even have a business plan. He said that his boss was going to give him his plumbing business. His boss said he never said that. Joe the Plumber, of course, turned on his boss and said, oh, he jerked me around. Never even was close to having a business. But just the idea that he might one day be rich, didn't want those taxes. See, I don't think it's about the taxes. I think it's more just a feeling that people are getting. And it's like the psychology of people like Joe the Plumber, where it's, I'm getting older. My dreams didn't work out. I didn't go pro. I didn't play pro football or baseball or, you know, I didn't do really what I thought I would, and I didn't go to college, or I didn't finish college. And whenever you see right-wing people, nothing sets them off like college campus entitlement. Nothing. Like, college campus kids do something, nothing sets them off like that. And I think it's because a lot of them didn't go to college, and they kind of feel like, these are opportunities that I would have loved to have had. And people who are in college, they're saying, I'm an entitled asshole. Like, like a lot of poor white people. I mean, sure, they've benefited from, like, institutionalized racism. But when you tell a guy who, like, works at a meatpacking plant that his life is, you live a charm life, so it's like a black kid at Harvard. Like, I think that's kind of too simplistic, and that's really, of course that's going to set people off. Like, of course they don't want to hear that, because when somebody's life is miserable, you got to look at the psychology of that. Like, to just dismiss it as racism, I think it's kind of oversimplifying it to where their lives didn't work out. They didn't go the right way. They took a wrong turn, or the brakes didn't work out, and they're seeing people like Obama and then all these celebrities, like Hollywood celebrities, constantly lecturing them about, you need to do this, you need to do that, you need to be more this, you need to be more that. And I think it's fueling a resentment that I think people are ignoring at their own peril.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, completely.
We know a lot of conservatives and a lot of liberals And so we know a lot of people who are socially conservative and a lot of people who are politically correct. I mean, is there any, like, things where you, what's the biggest eye roller or groaner or, like, what just makes you be like, oh, God. You know what I mean? When you see something, like, when you see something pop up, is there anything that you just kind of like, oh, man?
I think a lot of it are things that we've touched on tonight with this idea that the only way that you can feel safe is by someone going out of their way to make sure they don't say anything remotely offensive to you. Just the idea that you have to walk on eggshells around certain liberals to make sure that you don't say something that is offensive or upsetting to them, because, you know, they may have to go talk to their counselor or their psychiatrist.
Yeah, and I think what we're seeing is kind of like an arms race between the conservatives and liberals to who can play word games the best.
Yeah.
So you'll have somebody like Paul Ryan will never say anything like openly racist, but what he'll do is throw a dog whistle out there like, well, we know generations of inner city men, you know, and we know what he's saying when he says that, you know, but when he calls black people welfare bombs, he's like, I never said black, I said inner city. And it's like, well, why didn't you say inner trailer park? You know, because just as many people in Kentucky and Alabama and Georgia, just as many are on welfare, if not more. But he'll never say those words. And so it's like an arms race where they use more and more and more coded language. And then Democrats, like, they have to try to find it and seek it out and hunt and peck. And it's made it like an elaborate word game, where it's like nobody really means what they say. So Paul Ryan, he'll throw out a dog whistle and be like, generations of inner-city men have forgotten how to make a dollar without the federal government's help. And then a politically correct person might read that and be like, I think it's a hate crime what he just said, and we should never put up with this kind of racist language. And by the way, we need to make sure that we do reparations payments and empty out the prisons. And if there's any, they're trying to go so far over the top with their rebuttal to that. And then sometimes, like, when I see people's responses, I just think that they're not really listening to what you're saying. Like, they're really not hearing what you're saying at all. And we see that with a lot of issues. I think if people say, well, if people want to be politically correct, what's the harm? It's not really about, like, a harm. I think it's more about it's distorting reality. Like, you're basically warping reality. Specific issues would be something like with Israel and with Palestine, to where a lot of politically correct people have been like, Israel is apartheid. And they kind of go into this big long thing about it. And it's warping the entire discourse around it to where there's like, you're Islamophobic, you're anti-Semitic, or you're this, or you're that. And it's kind of to where you're not even able to get into the weeds of it. I mean, it makes an issue so, I mean, and people, Israel, Palestine, people get so emotional about that.
Yeah,
especially on the left-wing side. I see people getting like fired about this. Like, I mean, it's not really in my top 100 issues if I had to be pressed for an issue. Like, I don't really put like a lot of time and effort into thinking about it, but I've seen people get so emotional about it to where if you're like, in defense of Israel, okay, Islamophobe, apartheid, you're as bad as South Africa, you know, and liberals kind of get into that and say it that way, and it just, I don't think it's helpful, and I think it's actually making an issue a lot harder. When you're dumping all this emotion into these issues, I think it makes it impossible to get anything done, basically.
Yeah, it does. It's hard to get anything accomplished because you can't even talk about the issue. I work in inner city school, and talking about racism with my students, like, I can't even bring it up. If I bring up, even if I pull out statistics, I'm racist. That concept that, you know, people are so...
With stats, I've heard people say things like, I don't trust stats, or I don't believe in these numbers, or whatever like that. Like, even the math, I'm like, oh, you don't believe in math? Math has an ideology now, or whatever? Like, I think when people, with political correctness and with social conservatism, they're both tied to ideology. I'm becoming increasingly leery of, like, a really, like, 100% ideological black and white view of the world, because it's not that way, and it injects a lot of emotion into things, like you said, with education. That is a hot button to where if you even acknowledge the fact that schools who have a disproportionate number of students who can't speak English almost routinely fail those tests, okay, we'll just vote for Trump then, asshole. You know, and I'm like, I didn't say that. Like, I didn't say anything about the people. I said naturalization. But acknowledging reality of being like, this is what is bringing some of the test scores down. Like, you can't just go out and say, we're going to get rid of the teachers' unions, and it's all the teachers' fault. And I'm like, if you've got a kid that's in the fifth grade and he's on a kindergarten, like, English level, he barely speaks a word of English, like, of course he's not going to do very well on that contests. Like, and with learning disabled kids, it's basically the same thing, to where, like, with No Child Left Behind, it was like every kid deserves the same education, but they don't. And that's something people, if you say something like that, it's like setting off a bomb. Who are you to say that that boy with Down syndrome shouldn't be in this algebra class? And I'm like, he's not getting anything out of it. I mean, he's not getting anything out of it. Being your teacher now, a long time ago I was, and with No Child Left Behind, they would take kids who had, like, severe learning disabilities, like some kids who cannot even speak, and they put them in a room with kids in the 6th, 7th, 8th grades.
Regular classroom.
Grade level. Whatever their age is, it's what grade they'd be in.
Yeah.
They're not getting a damn thing out of those classes. And in fact, the kids who are in those classes are getting a worse experience. And it's not really like saying those kids shouldn't be in any school. They should just have different classes that are maybe more realistic. Like, of course, they're not going to be, they shouldn't be in there reading Catching the Rye because they're not getting anything out of it.
Yeah.
But like, even acknowledging that, I don't believe in leaving any kids behind. And I'm like, well, that's great. That's not what I said, but yeah, that's great. It's just so frustrating to take that stuff and be like, you can't even acknowledge what would work, what wouldn't work. It's also like a really slippery slope. And it's a slippery slope on both sides, because whenever you're willing to admit that, like, one thing could be true, like, you'll be like, oh, well, this criminal justice system is off. It's definitely racist, and it definitely has a racist bent, and black people are disproportionately jailed. You might get somebody telling you about how Church's Chicken is sterilizing black men.
Yeah.
It might be like some conspiracy theory that, like, it's shot off to the, well, if you think that's bad, let me tell you how dental floss has been used to keep it down. You know what I mean? Like, there'll be some conspiracy theory that gets shot off in a cannon off another direction.
Yeah.
I've heard that before. Church's Chicken sterilizes black men. And I'm like, wait a minute, we're talking about prison system. And really, it's a slippery slope on the liberal side. On the conservative side, it's a slippery slope, because if you even somewhat knock political correctness, people take that in the whole, like, you have a guy and you're like, man, can you believe these English students? I'm so glad you said something about it. You need to come to our Klan meeting. I'm like, wait a minute. No, I didn't, wait just a minute. Now, like, wait just a minute. They're like, yeah, those damn N-words, I can't. I'm like, whoa, I didn't say that. I did not say what you just said. Like, that's not. But that's what I'm saying. Like, both sides are losing any type of nuance. Where it's like, if you're saying there's definitely systemic racism in America and the institutions need to change and there needs to be this to happen, that opens up a back door into basically, well, we need to create a segregated safe space at Mississippi State.
Yeah.
And if you're saying on the other side, well, you know, political correctness, maybe it's gone too far, maybe people ought to be allowed to just give ideas if they're their ideas, be like, huh, thank God you said it. I'm wait a minute, I didn't say light that cross on fire. What the hell are you doing? You know, like, I mean, people take it so far. They just go from like 0 to 90. Nuance is dead and ideology is king, and it's just such a bad thing to have it this way. And it's only making the polarization worse. I mean,
people
say Congress is so polarized. It's because people are so polarized. Congress can only reflect what the people are.
That's true.
And that's not to say that Mississippi State doesn't need to change, because we both went to college in Alabama, and I can remember colleges in Alabama don't have great race relations, but Mississippi, oh my God. I mean, it was like every other week at Ole Miss, somebody burned a cross or somebody had like a noose in a tree. Or, I mean, Ole Miss and Mississippi State, they're like barbarians. Yeah. Whenever they came to the away games at other SEC games or whatever, I was like, oh my God, please go home. Like, it was like barbarians. There was the fraternity that put on blackface. Of course those kids should have been punished.
Yeah.
And there's all different things that Mississippi State and Ole Miss have been, they definitely have racist students and the fraternity culture and things like this, but this is not helping. This is not saying we need to tear down the fraternity culture and we need to integrate further. This is saying we want to be as big assholes as they are. We want to have our own group that they're excluded from. It's not saying rip away all these clubs and frats and organizations that exclude us and merge them together with something we created. It's saying, oh, they can have that part of campus, we'll take this part of campus. And that's such a bad, like, that's the wrong direction.
That's taking you back to a system that your parents and grandparents fought to get out of.
Yeah, and I think a lot of what surprises me sometimes is that a lot of the most politically correct people are in the blue states, a lot of the most politically correct people are the most segregated. And I've really noticed that. Like in Alabama, people are like, I hate black people. And I'm like, what about your brother-in-law? He's not who I mean. What about your coworker? That's not who I'm talking about. What about your neighbor? That ain't who I mean, you know? And they go, he's all right. It's like, yeah, they hate black people, but they're living next to them in the trailer park or on Skid Row or in the apartment building. Like, poverty is a great integrator because, like, you can't put up a fence when you don't have a yard. And so they're right beside black people all the time. And in Minnesota, the attitude was like, we love black people as long as they're nowhere near us. You know, they go to their part of town and we never see them, but we love them. And Alabama needs to really change. And I'm like, that was kind of some of the hypocrisy I picked up on, to where I was like, you're interacting with black people a lot less than what someone in the South might do, but you're kind of lecturing people. And it goes for people who even think that, like, that they're not that way. Like, you'll see a politically correct white couple, and they look like they could be brother and sister. They look so similar. And they're like, well, we all need to be more tolerant. And I'm like, you don't barely even know anybody who's black. And then there'll be like a Black Lives Matter person who barely knows anybody who's white. I mean, it kind of goes, I think that social conservatives on the Republican side, politically correct liberals, I think I've never found either group to be all that well integrated. I think neither group has really done the best job of, like, trying to incorporate other viewpoints and other types of people that might disagree with them.
Yeah, that's what I've seen too, just in my experience. I mean, they are, you're right.
Any predictions for New York?
I think Hillary takes it pretty easily. I don't think it's going to be that close.
If Trump loses, he's in trouble.
Yeah, yeah. That's
what
I was going
to
say.
To a guy who's insulted New York values, you're in trouble. I don't think Trump will lose New York. The only real drama in New York is how big will their victories be.
Yeah.
And I think Hillary can afford to only win by 5 points and still have a big night. But Trump, he really needs to get the majority of delegates. He's playing a different game. At this point, Hillary is just riding the clock out. She's just waiting till they run out of time. Bernie's saying, we need another debate. And I'm like, oh, my God, Bernie. Old warrior, go home. I mean, really, you know, you got to go home sometime. But Trump's strategy is very different because he's got to get that 12-37 or he's not going to be the nominee. They go to a convention, I don't like his odds. But I think on the Republican side, I believe New York has 95 delegates, so almost 100 delegates. And he's got to take the lion's share. If he can take almost every delegate in New York and New Jersey, and a couple of the big states coming up, like Pennsylvania, California, he'll get that number. But if the vote is remotely close, any of these states coming up, I mean, it's...
And really, what I was going to say, I don't think it's going to be close. I think he could get 80%, 85%.
Well, the only problem for Trump at this point, see, the states coming up are going to be terrible for Ted Cruz. New York, the week after that, we got Pennsylvania, Rhode Island, Delaware, Connecticut, Maryland. This is not Ted Cruz country. And the only problem for Trump is Kasich, and it seems like Kasich has hung in the race solely for the, if it's time for Bernie to go home, Kasich is like, why don't you just take a broom, why don't you sweep up the place if you're going to be here forever, you know, I mean, like, you lost this race 2 months ago, and you're still here. Whenever you see the election coverage, you're like, oh, you got Hillary and Bernie, and on their post out, Cruz and Trump. Kasich, he's out there too. Like, I almost feel like they're kind of tired of even putting him in the lineup, and you hear Kasich say stuff like, I'm the last governor standing, and I'm like, yeah, because you won't quit. You don't win a war by atrophy. You're not winning a war because you refuse to go home. Like, you just won't, like, you won't leave. And I mean, it's like, that's not winning.
Well, I know CNN did a town hall event with the Republican candidates and their families. I know they did one with Cruz. I know they did one with Trump, but I don't think they did one with
They did. They had Kasich and his family out there, but the reason, you said, I don't know if they did, because it was so boring and nobody watched it. Like, I mean, I think now my DVR is programmed to skip Kasich. Like, if he's on television, it changes channel automatically. Like, nobody watched it. It was why they had him out there. And the pictures they showed, they had still frames and they put it out there. It looked like an Irish funeral. It looked like a wake. They all looked miserable. I said, boy, it looks like they're having a barrel of fun. I hadn't seen this much fun since Bernie and Sharpton sat down to have a cup of coffee, where they both looked just absolutely miserable. Anyway, that does it for us. Michael, what's your web address?
BlueInAlabama.wordpress.com.
And of course, you can find me at AlabamaLiberal.com. Join us next week, where we're going to continue this series. This is the beginning of a trilogy of episodes we're going to do, kind of getting into some of the differences between Republicans and Democrats, and are there things Democrats could do a little bit better? Are there things liberals are actually wrong about? So join us for the second part of that series next week. All right, thanks, everybody.